Stem cell science is changing medicine and our understanding of human development. Learn more with the Stem Cell Channel. Visit uctv.tv/stemcell.
So I thought I'd start with a neurobiological but engineering perspective on the complexity of the human brain. You know, we tend to, it's really actually hard to grasp when you think about the brain as a system. And that's very much how we think about it. But first of all, I think what eludes a lot of people is an intuitive sense of just the incredible multi-scale nature of the brain, structurally, temporally. This is illustrating, you know, sort of that the hierarchical structural complexity. You know, the image on the left here is the tensor fusion imaging fMRI of the white matter tracts in the brain. You're looking at it sort of in cross section. This has been pseudo-colored using DTI. And then if you go down three orders of magnitude, you end up sort of at this scale. Now we're looking at individual neurons. And the mess, of course, up here is the neuropil. It's all the connections. The cell bodies tend to cluster together. I mean, this is what the types of networks that we're ultimately trying to understand how they're represented in processing information, trying to extract the algorithms, and then sort of being able to apply it to other engineering that retains the algorithms, but abstracts away, separates it from the wetware, the squishy wet stuff that the brain is actually made up of. The scale difference just between here and here is huge. And the example I like to give is an example in time, not in space. So if you wouldn't consider walking from New York City to San Diego, it would just take too long. But a single order of magnitude change is the equivalent of going from walking to driving. Now it becomes feasible. You can get across in you know, 4 or 5 days. A two order of magnitude change goes from walking to flying. You can get across in hours. And you know, three orders of magnitude, you know, which is roughly sort of the spatial difference here, would be the equivalent of, like, that technology doesn't exist, right? It'd get you from one end of the country to the other in a matter of minutes, right? So huge difference. And then if you go even further, you get down to this scale. Here you're looking at electron tomography. So you're looking at optical sections coming through. You can sort of see the total reconstruction. This is all the stuff that fills just the space between a single synapse. Okay, so phenomenal spatial and hierarchical complexity in the brain. It's very much a living, dynamic organ. You know, again, I think there's sort of this misconception that the brain is just floating there and you know, inside the skull and cerebral spinal fluid and CSF. But it's very much an active and dynamic organ that's constantly changing. And that's one of the challenges in when you're trying to understand the brain really sort of as an engineered system. You need the right tools and the right models to be able to do that. If we look at the complexity of the human brain, sort of in numbers, there's about 85 billion neurons in a typical adult human brain. Importantly, there's about another 86 billion non-neuronal cells. And the most important ones to me are astrocytes, at least from a computational perspective. I suspect in this audience, everybody knows what astrocytes are. Of course, they're one of the three main subtypes of glial cells. And although the classical role of astrocytes was in homeostasis and maintaining an environment that keeps neurons healthy, in the last 20 years or so, we know that astrocytes actually are able to, they contain all the molecular machinery capable of both participating and modulating neuronal signaling. So they can both listen in to synaptic signaling and they can actually secrete neurotransmitters, which we call gliotransmitters in that context. And so a process from an astrocyte will wrap around a synapse in a structure called a tripartite synapse or three parts synapse. And astrocytes form a network onto themselves. They form a large syncytium. And that plays a role in homeostasis. They shuttle away waste products and they bring glucose to areas of high neuronal activity. But they also participate in information processing in the brain in ways that we frankly do not understand computationally. So it's just amazing to think about that we have this other huge network. About 20% of these 86 billion cells are astrocytes. If you go back to neurons, each neuron has, you know, sort of in a typical artificial neural network, we think of kind of, you know, the way it's often drawn, it's, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 sort of incoming connections into a node. You know, typically a neuron has 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of synapses coming in. That's the degree of integration that's happening in just one neuron. And the consequence of all of this integration is the output is just one of those tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands downstream signals that's contributing to the firing of the next postsynaptic set of neurons in the chain. The total number of synapses in a typical human adult brain is about 10 to the 16 order of magnitude. Now, the number I like to compare that to, there's about 10 to the 21 stars in the observable universe. That's a few more orders of magnitude, and I just emphasized how significant that is, but it's still a humongous number. This is the network that we are faced with sort of attempting to understand from a theoretical and computational and engineering perspective. Now, typically, we take that incredible degree of complexity and we'll, you know, historically, it's been reduced down to something like this, you know, dissociated cultures of hippocampal neurons in a dish, sparse. I mean, I think it's a beautiful movie because this is calcium imaging. You can see that calcium, sort of that information almost, you can picture it kind of flowing from one end of the image to the other. Clearly, this network was stimulated up here in the upper right-hand corner. But it's very artificial. It's very false, right, compared to what the real brain is. And that's the point. And so we need better models. We have tools that can probe the intact brain, but of course, those have limitations because there's only so much you can do. And where I'm zeroing in on is precisely sort of this middle role that brain organoids might be able to play as a model. So what makes the brain unique, again, from a systems perspective? I like to contrast what the brain can do with sort of what machine learning can do. This is one of my favorite examples. These two images of a cow are completely different. They're physically completely different objects. The one on the left is a line drawing of a cow, black and white. The one on the right is a colored photograph, completely different angle. But you just show like a toddler just a few of these examples, and they very, very quickly start to create the concept, the class of what a cow is internally. So one of the things that brains does spectacularly well, which still eludes machines, is inference. Inference in the face of sparse, noisy, and always incomplete data, right? There's some fun, sort of interesting examples of just how limited machine learning is compared to the human brain still. This is an example of a news story. So what happened was there was a nationwide sort of news story that was on Alexa, Amazon's, you know, home assistant device. And in the newscast, they said, Alexa, can you order this dollhouse? Just as an example in the story. And of course, what happened was that was coming out of the televisions of thousands of people across the country, got picked up by the Alexa in people's homes. And all of a sudden, everybody started receiving dollhouses they never ordered. And it really kind of drives home just the very sort of limited and you know, prescribed nature of the technology still. Same thing happened to Google during the Super Bowl as well. This is a really good example. Language, and in particular, the nuances of human language, you know, just machines just do not get it, right? So this sentence, hey, thanks for defining the word many for me. It means a lot, right? So this is kind of comical because it's a play on words. When we read it means a lot, it has two meanings to us, right? It's the literal definition of many, but it's sort of a sarcastic comment. And this is the kind of stuff that just still completely sort of confuses machines. So if you think about the breakdown of sort of the classes of what makes the brain unique, these are really the key areas where the brain really excels, you know, again, from a computational and engineering perspective. And what we're trying to do is understand the underlying mathematics and algorithms for these different classes, both for so we can understand the biological brain, and importantly, understand where the biological brain deviates algorithmically, right? Because we're interested in disease from a systems engineering sort of definition and perspective, but then also for things like next generation machine learning. So we spent a lot of time sort of, this is ongoing work, really thinking about complexity and emergence in the brain. We have a particular interest in the role that geometry plays in networks. Biological neural networks are geometric networks, meaning there's a defined physical geometry to them. But there's also a defined finite signaling speed or conduction velocity. And what that does, the interplay between the geometry and conduction velocities sets up latencies in these networks. And those latencies is a constraint on top of the connectivity of the network that plays a huge role in how the network can represent and process information. And we've been formalizing these ideas mathematically. I'm going to show you one quick example of the effect that geometry can have on a network. This is what you're seeing here in the inset is a geometric network. Every node is modeled as an Itzakevich neuron, which is a simplified model of a Hodgkin-Huxley neuron. And it's a geometric network because the distances between the nodes and the edges here matter. Okay. And so we can do simulations that look like this, where we're simulating sort of the propagation of information on these networks. On the right here, what you're seeing are two raster plots that correspond to data from this network. Obviously time on the x-axis, and then from 0 to 100, because there are 100 nodes in this network, although they're not enumerated, along the y-axis. And every time you see a little dash mark as you move along the time axis, it means that neuron fired, right? This is the exact same network, completely different dynamical behavior. The only variable that we changed between these two networks was the signaling speed, the conduction velocity. And so what's happening is it's actually intuitive to explain in words. You have this geometric network. In the bottom panel, the conduction velocity is too fast. And so we drove the network external for the first 500 milliseconds. And then we stopped the external stimulus and asked the question, how is this network able to sustain inherent recurrent activity? In that bottom panel, the conduction velocity is too fast. And so all the signals reach their downstream nodes that they're connected to. They fire once, and then all the signals that come in after that are coming in while the network is still refractory, because these are neurons, so they have a refractory period. In the upper panel, and so there's no activity after that, because those neurons never see that signal. In the panel above it, when the conduction velocity, which represents a global network property, matches the internal processing timing of the individual nodes that make up the network, in this case, the refractory period and the time it takes for that neuron to process that incoming signal, when there's a balance between those two elements, then you get this very nice sort of sustained activity that you see there in the upper panel. And so that led to a whole theoretical framework that we've been developing, where it's a mathematical model of spatial and temporal summation, where geometry and latencies matter. And if you do that, it turns out several things. First of all, we were able to theoretically derive what we call a refraction ratio, which is the mathematical representation of this balance between the dynamics at a local scale in a network and the dynamics at a global scale. Okay, I'm going to show an example of a result from that. And so we were able to take this theory, do neuroscience, and then at the same time start to explore machine learning. And it's nothing more than the mathematical formalization of some of the principles I was just discussing from the previous slide. So really quickly, here's an example of a neurobiological application of that theoretical work. It turns out, I'm going to spare you the details, but I'll give you the punchline. It turns out that biological neurons, we looked at high resolution reconstructions of individual neurons. And in this case, we were looking at a population of basket cells, which are inhibitory interneurons. And it turns out that we calculated the refraction ratio along the axonal arborizations of like 56 different reconstructions, a total of close to 15,000 individual branches. And we calculated the refraction ratio, because the theory predicts that an optimal refraction ratio, this balance between global dynamics and local dynamics, should approach unity. That reflects sort of a good balance between the two. And it turns out that at least in this reconstructed data set, basket cells seem to optimize their morphology. They optimize their shape to preserve this refraction ratio, which was sort of a really cool result. One of the things we've been talking about with Allison for years now, actually, is can we use these theoretical concepts like the refraction ratio to think about neurodevelopmental disorders like autism from a systems engineering perspective? In other words, what we're after is, can we show in organoids and individual neurons from organoids derived from autistic patients a shift or a deviation in this refraction ratio? Because a shift in that refraction ratio, we know from the math, indicates sub-efficient network signaling, right? And so this is a major direction that we've been trying to pursue for a number of years. All of this is sort of coming together. The second example I'll show you is we used, again, I'm going to jump through the details just in the interest of time here, but we looked at the connectome of C. elegans, because of course it's still the only organism for which the entire connectome is known. And importantly, the geometry of the C. elegans connectome, although rarely used, is also known. We created a simulation environment of the C. elegans connectome, and we're able to show that when you stimulate a particular feeding circuit in the C. elegans connectome, and you look at motor neuron output populations, there's a very natural back and forth firing between contralateral motor neuron populations that biologically causes the worm to do this, to move towards that food source. And that's what you're seeing here. You can see the periodicity. This is the same theoretical model now in simulations that I've been talking about. We didn't program this behavior. The neat thing about this result is that it's inherent in the connectivity of the C. elegans connectome. So that's kind of interesting. All right, so I've already been talking about organoids sort of as this model, right? Dissociated models, it's too simplistic. The whole brain, it's just too hard to do some of this, work at this sort of network scale. And so organoids are this really, really interesting sort of model in between. And with Allison and some of his colleagues, how far that technology has come from a stem cell perspective and what they're able to do, I think is prime for being able to bring the theory together with the experimental. This is, I don't know, Allison, if you gave a talk yet, but this is his paper and the work that he did with Brad Wojtek, showing sort of the complex electrophysiology, showing that organoids, if you give them enough time, the electrophysiology starts to approach a firing rate of higher order organisms. Okay, first time it was ever shown. And this made a huge splash when it was published just over a year ago or so. Now there are challenges. This is the organoid toolbox that we've been developing between colleagues at Hopkins, here at UCSD, and then Microsoft, to develop the methods to allow us to extract the network information so that when we can then apply analysis tools like the refraction ratio. All right, so the last thing I want to show is just to leave you with some thoughts about sort of the challenges and questions, right? One of the big problems with organoids still that we have from a technical perspective is the connectome. It's a large structure, roughly 2 million neurons, 2 million cells in this three-dimensional sphere. That's a big structure. The truth is we really do not have yet a really good way of mapping a connectome of that size at the cellular scale. And so you're left with having to measure activity on the surface of the organoid using multi-electrode arrays, for example, or trying to do sort of single cell electrophysiology, right? So mapping the connectome is a huge issue. Doing high density geometry and connectome mappings that sort of mappings that preserve the geometry and connectome are even harder. So it's not just the connectivity, it's preserving that geometry. And then this is where the brain initiative comes in, because we really need to take advantage of brain initiative like neurotechnologies that can do high density electrophysiology inside sort of the intact organoid structure, right? Sensory integration, here's an important question. Is a brain really a brain when it's a thing in isolation, isolated from its environment with no sensory input, right? You know, do organoids need to be stimulated? From my perspective as a computational neuroscientist, this is an important consideration. Hybrid computing, the idea of organoids as an interface, sort of a computing system that blends wetware and hardware, right? That's an interesting sort of engineering objective. And if we solve all of these problems, then I think it's just going to be spectacular, because the mathematical tools and algorithms that we have that we can apply to this model of the brain is it's just going to be a fantastic period in neuroscience, I think.